production space is not designed to take care of people's health. It's designed to produce merchandise and get money.
Jorge, can you...
And what about the sexual harassment allegations as well?
There are several sexual harassment accusations. Workers complain that they have denounced this to management, and what management does is to move the supervisor from one plant to the next one instead of solving the problem, instead of training their supervisors, instead of raising really good standards.
And Jorge, can you talk about what happened to the workers after they had their rally last week? We just played Irma Gonzalez talking about being pregnant and being locked out of the plant. She couldn't get her medication. What the plans are for tomorrow, for Wednesday?
Yeah, well, we had to call the police, and the police came and opened up the plant to allow the workers to get their personal belongings. And the next day, we went with the workers to report to Human Resources, and Human Resources simply gave up, saying, we will pay you for the hours you lost yesterday in the lockout. So it was a round victory for workers. What the workers are demanding now is the plant, the management, to sit down with them. The management just hired a union buster to go and talk to them about how bad unions are. And what the workers say is, we are not talking about unions. We are talking about decency. We are talking about wages. We are talking about the heat in the workplace. They work at 95 degrees.
You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a finance coordinator. Our finance coordinator is responsible for accounting for and providing reports on KBOO's finances, ensuring that the financial systems function effectively, efficiently, and in a timely manner, and supporting human resource procedures and policies. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Applications are due by October 4th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
It is the KBOO Fall Drive, and our theme is The Sounds of Democracy. Everything you hear on KBOO is, in its own way, the sound of democracy, because we are a community radio station. Community radio is one of the most democratic types of media. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members so that we can keep the airwaves democratic and continue to bring you the valuable voices of your community. Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. We're featuring content focused on democracy itself and democratic ideas across the schedule this drive, and you can support KBOO by donating right now. Go to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click donate in the KBOO mobile app. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Governor Kate Brown holds a press conference about Oregon's COVID-19 response. Pfizer submits data to the FDA seeking to use its COVID vaccine in children ages 5 to 11. And Oregon's new electoral maps are approved and signed. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 28th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our Fall Fund Drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Oregon Democrats successfully passed plans on Monday for new congressional and legislative districts on mostly party lines. House Republicans had returned to the Capitol this week to provide the quorum necessary to conduct business after not showing up over the weekend. In the House, debate lasted several hours as Republicans criticized the political maps and accused Democrats of gerrymandering, The Senate, which passed congressional and legislative district plans a week ago along party lines, met briefly to repass the plan after it was amended by Democrats. Governor Kate Brown then signed both bills into law just hours before the midnight deadline set by the Oregon Supreme Court earlier this year. The new congressional district plan would create three extremely safe Democrat seats, one extra safe Republican seat, one that tilts in Democrats' favor, and one seat that is a 50-50 tie. The district that is a 50-50 tie includes fast-growing Bend, where expected Democrat growth could make the district bluer over the next decade. The nonpartisan group PlanScore found in its analysis of the legislative maps that they would result in relatively representative districts with a slightly disproportionate benefit for Republicans in the House and a slightly disproportionate benefit for Democrats in the Senate. The governor said in a statement, quote, "For the first time in 40 years, Oregon is gaining a congressional seat, another delegation member to advocate for the common good of all Oregonians. After the past year and a half, during which Oregonians have faced unprecedented challenges that have urgently required federal attention and resources, I am particularly grateful that the legislature has come together to pass today's historic legislation." End quote. Governor Kate Brown held a press conference today to discuss COVID-19 in Oregon and the state's ongoing response to the pandemic. Here's Governor Kate Brown speaking at the press conference earlier today.
I want to start our COVID update with some promising news. Our hospitalizations are declining, with 822 as of today. Cases are slowly declining as well. I know this isn't the fall that any of us had hoped for or expected. At the end of June, we were hopeful our communities would be largely free of COVID-19. Unfortunately, Delta changed everything. The good news is that while we still have a long way to go, it appears things are slowly getting better. And every day there is renewed hope as we see more people getting vaccinated, progress on vaccines for our 5 to 11-year-olds, and now the beginning of boosters for some of our most vulnerable. Thank you to everyone who is getting vaccinated and wearing your mask. Your efforts are truly saving lives. Last week, the FDA and the CDC shared their recommendations for the first large group of Americans who are eligible for booster shots. The Western States Scientific Work Group followed with their recommendation, which aligns with the federal guidance and which Oregon will be following. Oregonians who received the Pfizer vaccine at least 6 months ago that are now eligible to receive a booster shot include seniors, people living in long-term care facilities, people with underlying medical conditions, and people who are at higher risk of COVID-19 exposure and transmission due to occupation. You can schedule an appointment today. We have free and readily available vaccines across the state. Everyone who is eligible for a booster will get one. For those who have received the Moderna or J&J vaccine, like myself, I ask for your patience as we wait for further data and guidance from the federal government. For those who received the Pfizer vaccine but are not yet eligible for a booster, please know that you are still well protected from COVID-19. Boosters offer an extra layer of protection, and that is really important for individuals at higher risk of exposure or illness. But you are still fully vaccinated with the two doses.
That was Governor Kate Brown speaking earlier today about COVID-19 in Oregon and the state's ongoing response to the pandemic. The pharmaceutical company Pfizer and its partner BioNTech have submitted data to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration seeking to clear use of its COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 5 to 11. The FDA is expected to take at least several weeks to analyze data collected in a trial that included more than 2,000 children. A formal submission to request emergency use authorization of the company's vaccine is expected to follow in the coming weeks. Although the Pfizer vaccine has been available for Americans age 12 and older since May, millions of elementary school-age children are still vulnerable to the virus. Many of those children return to classrooms for in-person instruction this month, with some districts requiring masks and others not. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is the only COVID vaccine available to Americans who are under the age of 18. In June, Moderna submitted data to the FDA to use its COVID vaccine in adolescents ages 12 to 17. Johnson & Johnson is currently conducting clinical trials of its one-dose vaccine in younger recipients. Children face a much lower risk of severe disease and death, but more than a quarter of the reported weekly COVID-19 cases in the U.S. are in children under the age of 18. As progress is made for vaccines in children, Pfizer booster shots have started for those 65 and older and others in high-risk categories. Many Oregonians are now eligible to receive their booster shot, including those 65 and older, people who are immunocompromised or have certain health conditions, as well as frontline workers. The booster shot is only for those who previously received the first two doses of the Pfizer vaccine. It's recommended that those eligible get their third dose 6 months after their second shot. The Climate Protection Program was created by Oregon Governor Kate Brown last year. Critics are now pointing out shortfalls in the draft rules for the program. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Draft rules are out for a program designed to confront climate change in Oregon, but organizations say it doesn't go far enough to curb emissions and protect frontline communities. Governor Kate Brown created the Climate Protection Program by executive order in 2020. Priya Judge, with the group Power Past Fracked Gas, says there are flaws in the program's draft rules. She says the Department of Environmental Quality wouldn't regulate the state's biggest carbon emitters.
That is basically happening under the umbrella of exemptions on the entire electric sector in Oregon, which includes the top six stationary polluters of fracked gas power plants.
Judge says those plants are a major source of carbon emissions in the state. DEQ is holding its final public hearing on the draft rules online at 4 p.m. Thursday. The agency is accepting public comment through next Monday. The Climate Protection Program also establishes a Community Climate Investment Fund, which allows emitters to earn credits by contributing to groups aiming to cut emissions. Haley K. Scott with Beyond Toxics says there are concerns that there aren't sufficient sideboards to ensure frontline communities actually benefit from this program.
If a polluter chooses not to meet its compliance obligation, what they have to reduce in terms of their emissions, that BIPOC and low-income rural communities, how they define environmental justice communities in Oregon, actually benefit from those CCI investments that are intended to offset the pollution.
Kay Scott says the DEQ should require the program to achieve a one-to-one or greater emissions reduction. Alan Tournay with Southern Oregon Climate Action Now says rural communities are feeling the effects of climate change, such as from wildfires. He's frustrated carbon sequestration was taken out of the final offset program in the draft rules. But Tournay believes the biggest shortfall is that the Climate Protection Program doesn't address the full array of emissions.
The problem then is, even when they claim that they are going to reduce those less than 50% of the emissions substantially, there's still half of the emissions from the state that are not even covered.
The program aims to cut emissions to at least 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. However, the Oregon legislature passed a bill this year requiring all electricity sold in the state be clean by 2040. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
As Congress considers making school meals free for all students as part of the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Plan, school nutrition directors say their experience with free meals during the pandemic suggests the move will help more students succeed in the classroom and eliminate cumbersome administrative burdens, including collecting unpaid meal debt. Eric Galatis has more on the story with the Public News Service.
School districts had to get creative to ensure families could access critical meals during pandemic-related closures. And with kids back in cafeterias, nutrition directors are calling for continued universal access to breakfast and lunch regardless of a family's ability to pay. Shannon Solomon with Aurora Public Schools says when school cafeterias closed, she's proud of how her team found ways to meet customers where they were.
I joke with my team regularly that we were Dr. Seuss. We will feed our kids in a park. We will feed them on a bus. We pivoted, and for our customers that could not get to us, we got to them.
Current child nutrition reauthorization proposals, part of President Joe Biden's American Families Plan, would ensure that all students can access nutritious meals at school, after school, during the summer, and at childcare for free. Proponents argue the programs will reduce childhood hunger and obesity and support academic achievement. Katie Cosette with Englewood School says universal access helps remove the stigma of so-called poor kids' meals. It also eliminates the administrative burden of signing kids up for reimbursements and collecting unpaid meal debt. Cosette says the program has put a spotlight on a need that continues to exist today.
I will say we are serving more meals than I've ever seen our district serve, and they keep going up every day, which is incredible, and it really shows how valuable our program is to the community. When it's free, our families use it.
Solomon says universal access to meals ultimately helps students stay focused in the classroom and gives them the chance to be the best version of themselves they can be.
Nourishment is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's one of the basic fundamentals of a human being. Having school lunch and school breakfast be universally free to every single human being, student there is, should be a part of the school day.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
The Truth and Reparations Initiative focuses on the complicity of Christian faith communities in harm done to African American and Native American people. Faven Garazgahar has more on the story with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Last weekend, the Minnesota Council of Churches hosted the first event of an initiative to bring racial equity to churches across the state. Reverend Jim Baer Jacobs is co-director of racial justice for the council. He says the Truth and Reparations Initiative started last year to focus on the complicity of Christian faith communities in harm done to African American and American Indian people.
Some of our historic congregations at the Minnesota Council of Churches were here active congregations as these systems of white supremacy and institutionalized racism were built into the structure of Minnesota. And this is really a call to hold churches accountable and to be about what churches claim that they are about, which is the work of healing and repair.
The Minnesota Council of Churches plans on a 10-year process of truth-telling, education, and reparations for its 27-member churches. Last weekend's event featured keynote speaker Christine Dindizi McCleave, CEO of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. She spoke about persevering generational trauma resulting from Native American boarding schools and the erasure of indigenous culture. Reverend Pamela Gojiri of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth says it is essential to acknowledge the past for healing to take place.
We have to start at the beginning. We have to start at telling the true stories of history and how things have begun before we can even say anything about what we're doing today.
For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Faven Garazgahar.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center. Online at racialreckoningmn.org.
You're listening to a special Fall Fund Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, It's Preference, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 66 degrees. Today in history, in 1928, penicillin is discovered by young bacteriologist Sir Alexander Fleming. Having left a plate of Staphylococcus bacteria uncovered, Fleming noticed that a mold that had fallen on the culture had killed many of the bacteria. penicillin is still widely used today for bacterial infections, though many types of bacteria have developed resistance following extensive use. Today is also National Voter Registration Day, and we'd like to remind you that you can register to vote in Oregon at any time online by visiting sos.oregon.gov. The quote of the day is from American author and Buddhist meditation teacher Sharon Salzberg, who said, quote, "Voting is the expression of our commitment to ourselves, one another, this country, and this world." The nation's murder rate is up, the Senate votes on raising the debt limit, and a new version of DACA could be on the way. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm not sure there's any single factor that's driving it. I think it's a variety of things.
FBI Director Christopher Wray discussed the agency's Uniform Crime Report for 2020, showing nationwide homicides increased nearly 30% last year from 2019. The jump in homicides marked the largest single-year increase the FBI has reported since it began collecting the data. However, the 2020 homicide rate was still well below the nation's peak murder rate in the early 1990s, at 9.8 per 100,000 people. The Senate took a procedural vote on a continuing resolution to keep the federal government funded through December 3rd and increase the nation's debt limit, but the vote failed. 60 votes were needed to advance the measure. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
So I want my Republican colleagues to think carefully about the practical consequences of what they're doing. A default means, quite simply, the government cannot pay its bills.
Government funding is set to expire September 30th. Dozens of Massachusetts state police officers have put in their resignation following the state's COVID-19 vaccine mandate. Under Governor Charlie Baker's executive order issued last month, all executive department employees are required to show proof of vaccination on or before October 17th or be fired. Last week, a state judge denied a request from the state's police union to block the governor's mandate. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the White House is working to alleviate confusion over boosters.
Anyone who's had a Pfizer shot 6 months ago, go get another shot. If you took Moderna or J&J, they're still considering that data. Don't get the shot yet. Not approved yet.
President Biden received his booster shot of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine on Monday. In its first public safety alert in 6 years, the nation's Drug Enforcement Administration is warning about a dramatic increase in fake prescription drugs being sold on the black market, containing a potentially lethal dose of fentanyl. The DEA said the counterfeit pills can look like real oxycodone, Percocet, or Adderall, and are sold on the street by dealers and online. The Biden administration announced Monday it plans to create a rule to recreate the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program after a Texas court found the Obama-era program unlawful and halted new Dreamer applications. Finally, a federal judge approved the unconditional release of John Hinckley Jr., who attempted to assassinate former President Ronald Reagan in 1981. A federal judge said Monday Hinckley would be freed from all remaining restrictions next year if he remains mentally stable. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Canadian bishops apologize for Indian residential schools. Commemorations will be held Thursday for Orange Shirt Day, and a Navajo filmmaker is remembered for documenting Native life. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A wing of the Catholic Church in Canada has apologized for what it calls the horrors that occurred in Native residential schools for more than a century. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it was the first time the prominent arm of the church has apologized.
In a statement, the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops said it acknowledged the grave abuses that were committed by some members of the Catholic community at the schools. It also said it understood the residential school system suppressed Indigenous languages, culture, and spirituality. The statement went on to say that the Catholic bishops of Canada express profound remorse and apologize unequivocally. Cindy Blackstock is the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. She says the apology is an important step, but it's not enough. What's needed also is for the Pope to come to Canada and make a formal apology.
It's not clear to me that there's been a real deliberate learning within the church about the wrongdoing even after the schools close, their evasiveness at accepting responsibility, their legal maneuvering so they didn't have to meet their compensation obligations. All of that stuff needs a full ventilation, and there needs to be a clear commitment to learning from that as the church.
As part of the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement, the Catholic Church said it would raise $25 million for survivors. Less than $4 million has been paid of that. The residential school system operated in Canada from the late 1800s to the late 1900s. About 150,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children were forced to attend the schools. Native leaders say thousands were abused. Earlier this year, hundreds of unmarked graves were found on the sites of former residential schools. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Commemorations are planned across Canada for Orange Shirt Day Thursday. The day recognizes the harm Indian residential schools had on children and the intergenerational trauma. This year, September 30th, will mark the inaugural National Holiday for Truth and Reconciliation. Orange Shirt Day began in 2013 with a residential school commemoration project and reunion in Williams Lake, British Columbia. The orange shirt became a symbol after a former student shared her story of her first day at residential school when her shiny new orange shirt was taken away. Other students had similar stories. Acclaimed Navajo filmmaker Benny Klein has died. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the documentary filmmaker focused on the intersection of modern and traditional indigenous culture.
Klein was the founder of the Austin, Texas-based production company Trickster Films. It released the award-winning Weaving Worlds, which examined the contemporary pressures faced by traditional Navajo weavers and premiered at the 2007 South by Southwest Film Festival. Klein's 2011 film short Columbus Day Legacy also won numerous awards and chronicled the tense clashes over Denver, Colorado's Columbus Day Parade. Klein died on September 9th at his home in Tonalea on the Arizona portion of the Navajo Nation, where he had recently returned following the death of his mother. Klein's goal in his work, as he said, was to, quote, bring new voices and hidden stories to broader audiences. During his career, he premiered two films at the Sundance Film Festival and was a Sundance Institute Fellow for multiple years. Klein also broadcast Navajo language newscasts on KTNN Radio from the tribal capital of Window Rock and was a mentor to other Navajo filmmakers. He spent much of his time while not making films running marathons throughout the U.S. A memorial service was held for Klein earlier this month, and a cause of death hasn't been disclosed. He was 49. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A fungus found in Yellowstone National Park is a key ingredient in a new meat substitute. Chicago-based startup Nature's Fund is using the fungus to develop products ranging from chicken nuggets to yogurt. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2009, a team of researchers discovered a previously unknown microbe in the hot springs of Yellowstone National Park. Now, the fungus is the star ingredient in a new line of food products.
It was very, very high in protein, and it's actually a very exciting protein because it's a complete protein. There are really not that many sources of complete protein out there.
That's Thomas Jonas, CEO of Nature's Find. The Chicago-based startup developed a process to ferment the fungus and create what's now called five protein. They're using it to make a variety of foods.
So we've been able to make things that range from chicken nuggets, hamburgers, breakfast sausages, to yogurts and cheese.
Earlier this year, the company offered a limited line of cream cheese and breakfast sausage on its website. Jonas says the products will soon be sold at stores. He foresees growing demand for protein-filled foods produced more sustainably than meat and dairy.
That whole supply chain is completely inefficient and using a tremendous amount of resources, of land, of water, energy.
So Jonas says FI could provide a more climate-friendly alternative. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a special Fall Fund Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 28th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Romlagon, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland is joined by Jenka Soderberg to take a look back at KBOO's live broadcast from Occupy Portland 10 years later. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Radio Zine, featuring a variety of intriguing public affairs programming. Then at 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO's currently in our Fall Fund Drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News, this is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show covering the past, present, and future attempts by Portlanders to control how they are policed. I'm Sam Bowman, and this show was also produced by Jasmine. We've been focusing for several months now on the so far very gradual transition to a new system of police oversight. Last year, voters established a new, more independent, citizen-led board to have unprecedented power over certain police discipline and misconduct cases. What this new system will look like is the task of an all-volunteer commission that was sworn in July and has yet to meet. The current timeline for the new board has it taking over in 2023. We had planned to use this month's show to cover the city's renewed efforts to create a body-worn camera program, but the late summer chaos has caught up with both of us. For the bulk of this show, we'll be playing a piece we did back in March of 2019, when the city was last asking for public input on a body cam policy. Those efforts began in 2015, began again in late 2018, and ended when the city declined to fund the program during the 2020 budget process. Since then, the U.S. Department of Justice has demanded that the city establish a body cam policy if it wants to get out from under a settlement agreement that was designed to remedy the Bureau's consistent use of excessive force against people who are or appear to be in mental health crisis. The city had been in compliance with the agreement, at least by the Trump DOJ's standards, at the beginning of 2020, and then 2020 happened, and the city fell out of compliance, especially around the use and reporting of force. Body-worn cameras pose a number of advantages and challenges for the new oversight board in Portland, including the question of if and when a cop can view footage of an incident they were involved in, and how accessible the footage will be to the board, to journalists, and to everyday citizens. None of these questions were fully resolved by the time the city nixed the program last year. The following show from March 2019 is a snapshot of the end of the public comment period on the body cam policy and essentially represents where we left off last time. This show also includes audio footage from the city's controversial vote on the 2016 police union contract, which included debate over body-worn cameras. It's unclear at the moment if the city and the union have reached any agreement on body cam policies in this current round of bargaining. One big difference between 2019 and now is the about-face of Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, who opposed a body cam policy back then, saying that it favored police. She has primarily cited the political reality that without a body cam policy, the city will likely remain out of compliance with the DOJ, which will further complicate the creation of the new oversight board. So anyway, travel with me and Jasmine back in time to the innocent, carefree days of 2019. I'll check in now and then to remind you where and when we are.
So yeah, body cameras are pretty much, they're promoted a lot of times by police administration, and there are a lot of community activists who feel that body cameras have a lot of potential to help in police accountability, to help rebuild trust in communities where that trust has been broken, and to, in some ways, sort of, you know, legitimize the work that police are doing by helping to assure the community that it's being done fairly, and in a way that, you know, coincides with ideas of procedural justice. So what we're looking at is that the Portland's renewed efforts to bring body cameras to patrol officers here in the city. The efforts, you know, started in 2014 or 2015. They stalled for a while, and they've just recently been revived. And in the last week, we just concluded the third of three town halls that were intended to allow the public to have some input into specifically the body cam policy. So that's the policy that will govern, you know, when officers are required to turn the cameras on and off, when they can review footage, how long footage is retained, things like that. There is an Oregon law on the books that governs some of that, but a lot of questions still remain open. And so the Portland Police Bureau has said that they're giving the community and certain stakeholder groups input into the policy. But it's a little hard to tell just how much input the public is going to have in the long term, because as we said, this is not the first time this has been done. It was done in 2015, and there was a tremendous, they kind of snuck it into the collective bargaining agreement, the draft policy. They snuck it into the collective bargaining agreement as Mayor Hales was going out the door as a lame duck candidate.
Yeah, the collective bargaining agreement between the line officers union and the city. So, a binding doc, and the Portland Police Association, which is the city's police union, has long been, I think you pointed out that Daryl Turner, the president of the union, sent a memo during that time to the membership of the union stating that it viewed body cams simply as another police tool and nothing more. Is that?
Yeah, it says point number six of the memo is that body cams are a policing tool, no more, no less. So from what this issue sort of really represents and what will play out in the policy that ultimately is written and used by the Portland Police Bureau is that there's kind of a balancing act that happens in when body cams are used. On the one hand, like we said, the community really wants to see the body cams, body-worn cameras, contribute to officer accountability. But then on the other hand, the police unions and the membership tend to not want them to have any impact on officer discipline. So it's kind of hard for both things to exist at the same time, because they're fundamentally in conflict.
And back in 2016, when this came up for ratification by the city council, there was a lot of testimony from not just citizens, but also legal groups like the National Lawyers Guild, the ACLU, and back at that time, they took a lot of issue with the involvement of the Portland Police Association in forming a body camera policy, something that would have such an effect on policing in Portland. And we have a few clips of what they said. We'll hear first from the National Lawyers Guild, the ACLU, and then from a member of Portland Cop Watch. Again, this is back in September of 2016, during the last time the city tried to do a body cam policy.
Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, Mayor. My name is Ashley Albies. I'm with the Portland chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. We've been involved with police accountability and oversight in this city for many, many years. And we appreciate the opportunity to testify here today on this proposed ordinance that would ratify the collective bargaining agreement. As an initial matter, Mayor Hales, I was here and I heard you this morning say that staffing is a critical issue and that's part of the reason for negotiating this contract mid-contract instead of next year, less than a year when the current contract ends. And our position is if you're going to do it now, do it right. There are a lot of issues that are not addressed by this collective bargaining agreement that relate directly to police oversight and accountability. The National Lawyers Guild strongly affirms the right to bargain over the terms and conditions of employment. We strongly, strongly support labor rights. But where public policy related to police accountability and oversight relating to the safety of our community, relating to holding officers accountable when they violate the law, when they violate directives, when they threaten community members, when they make people feel unsafe, those issues are public policy issues that should not be bargained for behind closed doors. The police have awesome power in this society. They can enforce the law, they can arrest people, they can use force against community members, and they can take a life if necessary. The people here today are speaking out because they want one thing, and that is a check on this power.
Mayor Hills and commissioners, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm the legislative director at the ACLU of Oregon. As an initial matter, we are very disappointed that the whole CBA process has been done behind closed doors. There are a lot of issues in the CBA that impact our community in very serious ways, and the fact that the community has only now seen a draft CBA and a draft body cam policy so late into this process and just before ratification is very disappointing to us. That is particularly so as it relates to the body camera policy. Just to frame the issues, body cameras do have potential to be an oversight and accountability tool, but the policies that are attached to them have to be right. If the policies aren't right, they won't do what the community needs. And they won't feel like something that, you know, they've been offered to the community as body cameras are the solution to this problem, right? But if the policy is not right, the community is not going to see it that way. So then why do it at all?
Good morning. I'm Kara Landsman with Portland Cop Watch. And I guess I want to start by saying something that lots of other folks have said. Portland Cop Watch is very dismayed that the bargaining sessions were held behind closed doors. And we don't understand why the city doesn't strive for more transparency. The other thing that concerns us is that, as I think you said and other people again, we don't understand why the police union gets to decide policy issues. I'm an urban transportation planner, and if I came in for a job with the city, I said, well, before I accept this job, I want to negotiate level of service for roadways. I think all of our streets should be B. You would look at me like I was crazy. Why am I negotiating a public policy and best practices issue? That seems to be exactly what you're doing with the police. So these are the things that we don't like in the current policy. CERT is not required to use body cams. And they're the people, they're the officers who are most likely to conduct, to have something violent or untoward happen. Cops don't have to video mere conversations, even if frisking is involved. Cops can take advantage of sex crime victims, but interviews won't be taped. We have two Portland police officers who did in fact take advantage of sex crime victims, and we would have no record of that. The cops don't have to remind people of the right to remain silent. And you also seem to forget that state laws will cause faces to be blurred. Overall, it seems that these policies focus more on prosecuting civilians over holding cops accountable. And that's not surprising because you negotiated with police officers and their union. However, I want to talk a little about this process. I went to a couple of those forums. First off, they were very poorly attended. And secondly, well-intentioned or not, the police officers walked in and said, so what do you think we should do? Most people don't think about cop cam policy. What the city had a responsibility to do and failed was to conduct a best practices survey. to look at what other cities were doing and then come to the public and say, these are the best practices. These are some of the things we like. What do you guys think? That's where the forum should have started. It's like coming in, you know, you're going to see your doctor and your doctor says, I'm sorry, we're going to have to conduct surgery. Why don't you tell me what you think we should operate on? I mean, give me a break. Anyhow, in summary, because I have 7 seconds, put the contract on a hold, allow the mayor to bargain, and create better policies with better public input.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that was a member of Portland Cop Watch speaking at City Council in 2016, September 28th. Along with the former legislative director of the ACLU of Oregon and Ashley Albies of the National Lawyers Guild. And at the end there, she was talking about some town halls that they had way back in that process, probably 2015 or 16, I would guess. And they had those again just over the past month. And between the two of us, we were at all three of them. I think I was at all three of them, no big deal. And so what they were asking for at these, I don't know if you want to just read the...
So yeah, sort of like the end of the feedback there was that it's not really necessarily the most constructive thing to bring community members in with a blank slate and ask them sort of, what do you think we should do? So this time the Portland Police Bureau did go out and consult with, and the mayor's office, representatives in the mayor's office, did go out and consult with other agencies, and they compared policies, and they picked a few things that, a few topics that weren't covered by Oregon law that they focused on as policy issues. So one is mandatory activation and use during demonstrations, when they can't activate, when they should deactivate, when can they deactivate the cameras at their discretion. But the biggest thing was this question of officer review.
Yeah, and so that would mean, in a nutshell, should police officers be allowed to review the camera footage before they either write a report or give testimony? And during the meetings, I think people made a pretty clear-ish distinction between, like, regular, like, walking down the street, everyday police work and so-called critical incidents, which would be, you know, mass protests or officer-involved shooting.
Uses of force
mm-hmm. of all kinds.
And to be honest, I mean, that distinction was made by the moderators who were members of the police
True.
Bureau.
Yeah.
But I didn't hear a lot of members of the public who really, for whom it really made a big difference. For everyone that we listened to that wasn't either a current or former employee of the police bureau, nobody really understood why officers would need to review footage.
Hi, folks. Just a reminder, this is a rerun show from March 2019, covering what was, at the time, the ongoing public comment period on the city's attempt at a body cam policy for police. And so, right now we're going to hear some of the things that people had to say, especially at the second forum we went to, which was at Matt Dishman in Northeast Portland, and that had probably the most people show up. And before we play, I want to say, at the forums, I would be surprised if they heard from as many as 25 straight-up members of the public.
Yeah, I think sparsely attended is a consistent theme at these things for reasons yeah. that are not totally clear.
At the last one, it was maybe 10 of us around a table, most of whom were bureau employees,
one of whom was a body cam vendor, and
yeah. Two of whom were me and you. So, this is some of the things that people said. And in this first clip, the woman is speaking to Officer Brad Friedman with the Gun Violence Reduction Task Force, and is then interrupted by a retired police officer.
why wouldn't you just do things as normal and write up your incidents reports and then look at the camera later? Why would you look at the camera first before you wrote your...
Well, I can speak to that. That some of the things that have been said in other places is that, you know, officers rely on their reports. They are, you know, they are official record of an incident. There are some, there's concern from officers that any discrepancy in the written report versus what the camera shows could be construed as some type of an officer purposefully omitting facts or changing facts or inaccurately portraying information could be used as a possible means for at a trial to discredit the officer or make undermine the officer's, you know.
I don't know if it wouldn't get to that. I mean, to me, it seems like great sociological data to work with anyway, because even when you're like doing a lineup, you don't know, you can't recognize people from the. So I would just think they would go about their regular business and then look at the footage to explain or confer, or if there are gaps or omissions, and they could see it clearly, but there's still an incident report right after the incident happened from that day, just as we always did. We wouldn't be depending on these cameras.
Well, once you know it doesn't always happen like that.
We wouldn't be depending on these cameras.
It doesn't always happen like that. There's not a timeline that says officer has an incident, officer goes and writes a report.
Do you think officers should be allowed to view videos? And if so, or if not, under what circumstances?
I think not. I don't think the officer should be allowed to watch it pre-processing. I think they should be allowed post-processing. And the reason why I think that is
if I'm the public and we have a shared experience, and if I don't get to have ownership of that video at the time, you have ownership of that video, it puts me at a disadvantage. But if you have an objective third party reviewing it, then I give my account, the officer gives his account, and then after the post-processing, we review it to see where that lines up. I think that'd be a better way to use the video so that I feel that I have some safety, some security.
I agree with not having the officer review it too, because what is the whole point of officer wearing a camera if he's going to review it first?
I don't think the officers should routinely be able to review the video, because I don't think you want to differentiate between when there's some event that could be detrimental, some discipline, maybe some action against the police bureau, and everyday work. Okay, and now who decides which is what? Who decides when an officer does it on a routine basis, or who decides the officer needs to look at this maybe because there's a pending lawsuit against the city or some discipline against the officer? Who gets to decide? Okay, and so if you just have this, the video is only used for training purposes and doing a review, I think that would be more consistent, and I think you get a better response from the public.
But there's no way that a cop should be able to go look at something before he's able to write down his police report. Because he can put anything in the police report from the video. He just adds stuff as he wants to. That he did not even notice or see in the situation. It could have been something super simple that somebody could have easily walked away from. And then they get to court and they got 15 tickets on stuff they don't have no idea about. They will look out for some of their soldiers if they like them. If it's a cop that he likes, he's going to believe him more than he's going to believe the criminal that he's arresting. So if somebody says, I beat him up and this and that because he kicked me in the leg, the supervisor's going to look at that video mainly for the kick in the leg than anything else that happened in the video. Because he wants to believe his person. His person works for him. He wants to believe the good guy that's solving all the problems.
So that was several community members giving opinions to the Portland Police Bureau on the body cam proposal. And that was at Matt Dishman Community Center about 2 weeks ago. And right now we're going to hear some testimony from, we heard her before, but Kimberly McCullough, the former legislative director of the ACLU of Oregon, speaking with former City Commissioner Steve Novick back in September 28th, 2016.
I've got a question for you, and I don't want to get too into the weeds because we've got a lot of people that want to speak, but I know that we've heard a lot in the past several years about eyewitness testimony often being inaccurate, not because people lie necessarily, although sometimes they do, but just because people don't recall correctly. I think some people think that if you give the officers a chance to review the body camera footage, then it'll save them from lying. But it'll also just save them from misremembering. My concern, though, is that if we allow officers to review the footage, we don't allow the other people involved in the incident, so the suspects or whoever, to review the footage, then you will often wind up with situations where it looks like the police officer is truthful and the suspect is not, just because one had an opportunity to review the footage and the other did not. So I'm curious if you would consider the possibility that having police officers review body camera footage might be okay, as long as you allowed suspects or others involved in the situation to also review the footage before they give a statement.
Thank you for the question, Commissioner Novick. I totally get what you're getting at, but I think we have a slightly different approach, which is that the officer should write their report without reviewing the footage. They can then review the footage after that, right? And then they can make clarifications. If there's just a problem with, you know, eyewitness memory being faulty, there are there's a slew of recitals in this agreement, in the body camera policy itself, about that very exact issue. And I think there's going to be an understanding on the part of judges and so on that memory can sometimes be infallible, but what letting them review the footage ahead of time does is, in those situations where someone is intentionally being deceitful, we won't catch it. We at the ACLU have actually been brought to our attention situations where officers have learned to move their body in such a way that the body camera doesn't actually pick up the footage. And there was one particular incident where they were yelling at this man, "Stop resisting, stop resisting, stop resisting," while they beat him. And they turned their chest another direction, and then an eyewitness caught it on their own video. Now, if that officer had been able to review that footage before they wrote their report, then they'd be like, oh, look, I managed to do what I was trying to do. And now I'm not saying that all officers lie, right? I realize that there's a lot of police officers that go into this job, and the vast majority, who want to protect their communities. They want to help people. But the problem is that we get these stories of officers harming people and lying. And this right here is something that we hear from the community is a huge concern. So I just feel like it's going to unravel the positive impact of body cam footage. So write the report, review the footage, have the opportunity to make updates. And if there's some sort of fallibility there, a judge is going to get that.
So the PPA's contract is up for renegotiation by June of next year, so maybe as early as the end of this year. But we don't know how that negotiation is going to go, and we don't know how it will affect the body cam proposal necessarily. But we do have an insight into the views of one of the current city commissioners, who back in 2016 testified at that same hearing and was at the time president of the NAACP, Joanne Hardesty.
And I think the Trojan horse is you take away the 48-hour rule, and then you have an unlimited amount of time to review video footage. And so now it's not just 48-hour rules that hours that we're annoyed with. Now you've got days, maybe weeks, maybe months before police officers will have the opportunity to review video that only police officers can review in the first place. You cannot present that as an accountability measure when the only people that get to see the video, the only people that decide when to turn it on, the only people that decide what's important in the video are police officers. That's ludicrous.
So the policy that that is currently, you know, being negotiated behind closed doors now, you know, sort of, it remains to be seen what happens with the accountability aspect of it. It's possible to write the policy in such a way that officers are allowed to review footage prior to writing reports, and in that case, it's really hard to see body cameras as a potential accountability tool. So I guess the question is, if they're not that, then what are they? And that question was answered pretty succinctly at the third and final body cam forum.
I feel like maybe we need to start at what the purpose of the body cameras are, because at the beginning of the slide, like the main purpose was the shooting
Michael Brown,
and wanting to have accountability use the footage like in court cases. Like and kind of the conversation piece here really brings up more like it's more of a tool to actually just gather additional evidence for a criminal case and not necessarily to from the point of view of monitoring the police bureau.
It's both ways. It's good for accountability for the police, so we can resolve complaints, we can get a better picture of what happens in critical incidents, which are probably the most recognizable reason that people want the cameras, is to find out or to get something other than what the officer says. You get a impartial video footage of what actually occurred. But it's not just that we're only going to use it to hold the police accountable. It is evidence if a crime is committed, so it will be treated like any other piece of evidence. So it falls on both sides. The main purpose that we're looking at it is for that trust and accountability, but there will be the other side where if we have something on video and it will help in a prosecution, it will be used.
That was Tammy Mayer, the current program manager of the Portland Police Bureau's body-worn camera project, speaking at the third and final town hall.
So that was me and Jasmine back in March 2019, covering the then-ongoing rollout of a body-worn camera policy for the Portland Police, which died during the 2020 budget process and was recently revived. We'll most likely have an update on that and perhaps the new Citizen Oversight Board next month. Totality of Circumstances is a monthly show and will be back on Tuesday, October 26th at 5:30 p.m., right after the KBOO Evening News. Good night.
Portland.
Camera activist Betty Lee has captured 30 years of street protests in Portland, from the 1989 demonstration condemning the racist murder of Mulugeta Sirah to the Black Lives Matter protest.